Assalamu alaikum, everyone. Thank you again to ILN, especially to the organizers, Ali, co-founder Lord Kamal, of course, Madam Chair Tasneem, as well as Ahmed Bashir and others who have been involved in this. I will respectfully take a different tack than the two excellent presentations you've already heard from those who have been focusing on Muslim majority countries. As has been described already, my paper is entitled, Can Muslims Save Democracy? Muslim Minority Communities Resisting Illiberalism. It's an interesting thing to consider in this day and age, especially coming from the United States, because the debates are almost singularly and uniquely focused on one man who served as the president already and is seeking office again. And within that, you can laugh, it's okay. And within that construct, the debate is oftentimes framed as whether democracy is under an existential threat. I'm sure that democracy in the United States is not, contrary to some of the media pundits, going to lurch into dictatorship. But there's something far more nefarious and pernicious that's happening, and that is democracy lurching from being a liberal democracy to an illiberal one. So I suppose the choices then are between a stake through the heart of democracy or democracy dying with 1,000 paper cuts. It's still an open question to consider, not only in the United States, but elsewhere. Modern Western societies define themselves as the creators and bastions of liberalism, an ideology that centers the individual over the collective and espouses freedom as the paramount virtue. The key defining features of these societies are liberal democracy, rule of law, secularism, and a market economy. Of late, however, each of these features is facing some form of erosion. Market economies have been infected by neoliberal policies that corrode the free market, creating greater income disparity and inequality. Secularism is giving way to religious nationalism and religio-ethno-chauvinism. The rule of law is often flouted in proportion to one's power, positionality within society or geopolitical spaces. And democracies across the world are challenged with the phenomenon of illiberalization. With the end of the Cold War in the early 1990s, there was jubilation in the West that its values had conquered all possible alternatives. And for the third time already in the morning, you heard, of course, from His Excellency, the Minister of Foreign Affairs, as well as Dr. Bijan. Let me invoke for you yet again Francis Fukuyama, who in his 1992 book, The End of History and the Last Man, giddily heralded the victory of liberal democracy over communism, declaring that it would be the sole political model to prevail for the rest of human experience. Unfortunately, Fukuyama's elation was premature. China began its ascent, demonstrating economic dominance within a dictatorial model. Similarly, Russia has shown that authoritarian regimes cannot be discounted or dismissed. And the world's largest democracy, India, is descending into deeper illiberalization by the day under the administration of Prime Minister Narendra Modi and the BJP party. These refutations of Fukuyama's thesis are important to note as much of how the world has changed toward illiberalism in the course of a mere three decades. Now, traditional liberal democracies are not immune to the forces of illiberalism. The United States, Great Britain, France, and other countries throughout the European Union have recently reassessed whether liberalism is indeed a cardinal virtue worth upholding. And I submit to you that there are several areas where we see this kind of erosion. Let me begin by talking about freedom of speech. Cancel culture, woke culture, and academic freedom being under attack along with truth in general. In the United States, for example, in the state of Florida, critical race theory, as well as African American studies, are under assault by the governor of the country, or of the state, as well as somebody who's seeking office as being the leader of the country, Ron DeSantis, having a chilling effect then on academic freedom. We find similarly in the area of freedom of press that there is an unprecedented threat to journalists. In India, as I mentioned before, we have the rather courageous Rana Ayub, who is constantly on the so-called hit list by the government and faces all kinds of threats, not only to herself, her life, but also her family and her career. Most recently, for example, she was applying for a visa to enter the United Kingdom for a literature festival. The Indian government, in fact, contacted the British High Commission to deny her a visa to the country to present at this festival. The British High Commission did not completely accede to the Indian government's request and demand, but they simply slow-walked her visa, so she was denied entry for the first weekend of the festival, but luckily she was able to present at the second. Also dealing with India and the United Kingdom, the BBC broadcast a documentary a few months ago that was highly critical of the Modi regime and his involvement in the 2002 pogroms in Gujarat. When the Indian government complained, they took their actions, number one, by raiding the BBC offices in Delhi under a trumped-up charge of tax evasion, and then also demanded, with the audacity that they have, that the BBC in fact pull the documentary completely. What was also quite telling was that Prime Minister Rishi Sunak did not defend the great institution of the BBC, nor did he defend the hallowed principle in democracies of the freedom of the press. So much for defense contracts. There's also, of course, the assault on the freedom of expression and privacy in the United States. This has manifested itself in last year's Supreme Court decision of Dobbs versus Jackson Reproductive Centers. But we also see this in France, of course, with the existential threat to French society, the hijab, and of course, more recently, the move to ban the abaya in state schools. Taking it to its most egregious, French politicians have included such statements as saying that Muslim women should make themselves available to French men. Also in the area of liberal democracy being under threat, we of course have the very cornerstone of democratic principles, and that is the right to vote. In the United States, voter suppression through various laws and new obstacles have become quite commonplace, but we find elsewhere the delaying of elections. The fact that in the United Kingdom, for example, there have been five prime ministers and only one of them was actually elected by the people in recent succession shows that the mechanisms of democracy are quite problematic. As I mentioned, there are other features when it comes to modern Western societies, including the market economy. This has become rather farcical when it comes to neoliberal policies, unprecedented wealth disparity and privation, and an uneven distribution of wealth. There is also, of course, the issue of secularism. In the United States, India, and elsewhere, the privileging of majority religions and the rise of religio-political nationalism. Now, in the past two decades, we have seen that Muslims in so many so-called liberal democracies have been subjected to securitization and added surveillance. The 9/11 attacks in the US and the 7/7 attacks in Great Britain, to which Lord Kamal alluded, have served as catalysts and justifications to implement a series of limitations on civil liberties and civil rights under the aegis of combating terrorism. I think it's important to also realize that the group that has been targeted or used as the so-called guinea pigs for many of these policies happen to be the Muslim minority communities, which then evokes a new title to consider these Muslims, the canaries in the coal mine. Now, some of you may be familiar with the metaphor that in the Industrial Revolution, in coal mines, it was common practice to send a canary in a cage down the mine shaft to test whether there were toxic vapors and gases there. If the canary came back dead, it meant that, of course, the fumes and the gases would be toxic to human consumption as well. If the canary came back alive, then it was appropriate to send the coal miners down and fend for themselves and extract the much needed coal. Well, in that sense, Muslims have served that purpose rather well. And of course, without much surprise, many of these securitization policies and programs do not only apply to Muslim citizens, they also apply to societies at large, further eroding then liberal democracies in these locations. Well, when it comes to these ideas, then I suppose the question to ask ourselves is there a mechanism within Islam? Is there a mechanism within Muslim agency to try to combat this kind of illiberalism? Well, first, let's talk about what are the two challenges to humanity that illiberalism brings about. First is the ability for people to address, acknowledge, and adapt to cultural and civilizational pluralism. As technology, communications, and migration catalyze diverse engagement, the recognition of human and civil rights will similarly increase, all the while confronting the inevitable reactions of ethno-chauvinism, sectarianism, and tribalism. Current lurches toward hyper-nationalism, neo-fascism, and nativism are rejoinders to the post-national, transnational nature of illiberalism. In addition, illiberalism is facilitating the new rise of a new dimension of science in the case of artificial intelligence and automation at an unprecedented level. How much of this is going to then have a consequential impact on liberalization and whether democracy has the kinds of safeguards to prevent the exploitation and misuse and abuse of such technologies remains a very, very open question. With its current lurch toward Hindutva, India provides an additional assay for the phenomenon of religious nationalism, which then threatens not only the world's largest democracy, but the world's largest Muslim minority population of 200 million plus, which constitutes somewhere around 10% of the entire global Muslim community. The election of Narendra Modi in 2014 and the emergence of the Bharatiya Janata Party as the dominant political force in the Indian parliament have evoked a newfound departure for India's secular orientation, emblematic of the diverse nation's social and legal construction since its independence over 70 years ago. Yet Prime Minister Modi has asserted a robust Hindu narrative and allegations of a state-endorsed religio-chauvinist policy persist. Hindus constitute the overwhelming majority of India's population, and certainly far from all support Modi or his promotion of Hindutva. But it is difficult to, at this point, ascertain how the tyranny of the majority can be reversed. While there does not appear to be a nexus between religious law and the indispensability of the state to procure it, religious law is nonetheless leveraged as a validator of the majority's demographic dominance as the essential marker in a nation's identity construct. Whether that is something that is being promulgated by New Delhi or Washington, D.C., again, is something that gives us pause when looking at how democracies operate today. Ironically, it is illiberalism that is expediting the promulgation of this notion as some nations, particularly those that are multicultural, seek an identity to assert and present in a world where lines of distinction are becoming increasingly more nebulous. As globalization, in that case, becomes far more pervasive, we find even the so-called stable democracies are suffering from a wobble when it comes to not only their identity, but sense of security, as well as sense of definition. How then can Muslims save democracy? I would suggest that there are really two ways to do so. One is to draw upon the experience in the kind of dangers and discontents of illiberalization and being targets of the violations of democratic principles and visions that so many Muslims living in minority status across the world face. Secondly, there's the recognition and application of intrinsic, democratically oriented Islamic principles. According to the scholar Abdulaziz Sachadina, Islam not only is compatible with democracy, it possesses the essential components of council, shura, and consensus, ijma, that democratic societies need. In addition, as a complete socio-political religious system, Islam can furnish, as Peter Berger, the sociologist, describes, a plausibility structure to provide society with a totalistic functional model that creates stability and flourishment. A functional society can only exist as reflected by how it treats its most vulnerable, its most weak, and its most marginalized. In that regard, many democracies fall short of that particular conceit, especially in the way that they treat Muslims. Along with shura and ijma, Islam, of course, also has the focus and primacy of adl, justice, as well as five principles that Ghazali describes: deen or faith, nafs, life, nasl, which is of course oftentimes described as lineage or progeny, but I would suggest it also means continuity, akal or intellect, and also mal or wealth. Muslim civic and political engagement can then go ahead and not only serve in the role of being canaries in the coal mine, but holding a mirror up to democracies as being, in many places, the second largest religious communities to show where the fissures and the fault lines lie when it comes to the erosion of liberalism. Despite the calamitous trauma that has befallen the Islamicate in the past 200 years with colonization and imperialism rupturing its efforts to engage in an organic interaction with Western emanating socio-political developments, including liberal democracies, Muslim societies are equipped with fundamental values and systems that can allow it to not only implement liberal democratic modalities within them, but also rectify existing dysfunctional democracies.
Professor Said, 5 minutes left.
I don't even need that, but thank you. Give me 5 seconds. A strong legal system affirms a strong commitment to the rule of law and justice, which Islam possesses. It also possesses a long-sustained tradition of pluralism and tolerance, with the dignity of the individual centering social formations. As illiberalism threatens democracies across the world, Islam and Muslims are well-positioned, both within their respective locales and also as members of a 2-billion-strong ummah, to protect and even save malfunctioning democracy from itself. Thank you.
Thank you very much.